Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
I think one of the lessons has to be about things are not always as we perceive them. In other words, the lesson starts with the last week where the prophet of Hashem said that they're so more numerous than us. How is it possible that we would escape? And he said, well, you just don't see our side. And he opened his eyes and he could see all of the heavenly hosts. Over here, the officer was skeptical. Elisha said that the only thing that was holding the people back from the famine was the fact that we had sinned. But once we had belief in Hashem and Hashem opened the storehouses, so to speak, there'd be plenty of food. And he was skeptical, and sure enough, the food, if Hashem wills it, things can change very quickly, or they're not as we perceive them to be. That's the kind of the message that we have to, our perception of things isn't always as they are. And so we have to be careful when we're skeptical. We tend to say there's no hope or things can't change or they, we see from the prophets that there's a different dimension to life, a different, things don't always exist in the way in which we see them. Even with that, there was something to it that the salvation came through the hands of the lepers, so to speak, that, it wasn't a complete salvation. We were limping along. But that in itself is a message to us. Sometimes we feel we're not worthy that Hashem will help us. We still have plenty of sin on our hands. But even if we make a small gesture, that's sometimes enough. And in some ways, that was the message over here with the kingdom, that they didn't become perfect, but it was enough to end the famine. It was enough to accomplish what it needed to. Okay. There is there's one other idea which we run into, which I wanted to mention, which is that the officer gets a very strict judgment. He's skeptical. He says, "Are you going to create heavens in the windows in the heavens? It'd be impossible for there to be enough food to possibly change the price." And he gets a very strict judgment. His judgment is, you know what? It's going to happen, and you're not going to see it. And so he gets trampled. Why were we so strict with him? What did he do that was so terrible? He was skeptical? Well, most of us would be skeptical. If we were living through a famine where they're eating donkey heads and they're eating pigeon dung, then I'd be skeptical that if someone would say, oh, tomorrow you'll have as much food as you can imagine, right? So what did he do that was so wrong? And the problem is that the king was about to do teshuva, was about to believe in Hashem and to believe in the prophet, and what held him back was the skeptic. That the person said, oh, it's impossible. And the skeptics are really the, in some ways they feel what they do is harmless. In other ways, they cool things down. One of the first skeptics, they say, was Amalek, that when we came into the land of Israel, none of the nations were going to mess with us, and Amalek said, oh, I could take them on, and he went, and he was the first one to go against us, and he lost. But once you have a skeptic, once you have somebody that questions it in a certain way, it's never the same. You lose that feeling, that strength of conviction. Many times somebody embarks on something, whether it be religious or otherwise, and there's a skeptic and says, oh, you'll it's too late for you, or there's no way, whatever it is, whatever the skepticism is, there's a building campaign, there's another campaign, somebody wants to do a good thing, and somebody just dampens it a little bit, throws some words out, and says, you'll never do it. And you never know what kind of harm that skepticism does, because the person was ready to go, he was excited about it, and then there was that person who put the damper. Sometimes we say that it's harmless, and sometimes we say, no, it causes a lot of damage. It says that people, there were skeptics that Avraham really had Yitzchak. They said, he's such an old man, there's no way he could have fathered that child. Or the so that it says that they made, Sarah ended up nursing all of the children that day, and they made it that the child looked like his father. And why? Because people, skeptics do something. Just ask the politicians with all this negative advertising. It doesn't have to be true. It doesn't make a difference whether it's true. Just get people skeptical. If you get people skeptical, you never know what kind of damage it can do. So our challenge is, you know, on the one hand, we seek out truth, and we're supposed to be skeptical when it comes to finding real truth. In other words, or just, you know, there are a lot of sales pitches out there, and we say, yeah, sure, I'll lose weight in my sleep, and I'll get 10 years younger, and I'll do all. So, of course, we should be skeptical. But then, on the other hand, when a group of people wants to do a good thing, or let's say somebody wants to turn out a new leaf, and we know, this guy has said this 100 times, he's never going to, he said, oh, I'm going to go to synagogue, and I'm going to be different, and we know he's not going to do it. Don't say it. Don't be the one to be the skeptic. Sometimes a skeptic can do, it could be he really planned on changing or doing something, or she planned, or but sometimes a skeptic can cause a lot of harm. It's funny, I remember very, very clearly the when I was at a certain stage of my life when I was planning on becoming a rabbi, and I still rings in my ears the words of a certain skeptic, you know, who said, oh, you'll never, you know, it's not for you, you'll never do it. And the only thing was there, I think I tried even harder because I wanted to show it. But, you know, people, sometimes, you know, my only point is you have to be careful. Sometimes a skeptic can cause a lot of harm. And so that's why at the end of chapter 7, this guy who's the skeptic and says, oh, yeah, there's never going to be enough food to do that. And so Hashem says, there'll be plenty of food, but you won't get to enjoy it. And in other words, because his skepticism over here was harmful. And so I think that's one of the lessons that we have to take out, that if we're skeptical, we shouldn't, it's okay to, you have to not use it in a way that could be, you know, here the people were looking to Hashem and they were hopeful, and he was trying to dampen the effect. And so, therefore, this guy, he gets trampled. Okay. Chapter 8. Balisha Diber Elisha Asher. Yeah, so now this chapter is where we finished the basic miracles of Elisha. There's a certain, they were coming one after another, you know, with all the different. Now, some people say this is like a, once we finish that, we go back and mention something earlier. It's kind of just an interesting thing. This is an event that takes place at some point after the famine. The Elisha Diber, Elisha Shehich Yesbana. Now, if you remember, Elisha had the woman from Shunem, who had made the house for him to stay at, and who had had a child after all those years, and then the child had almost died, or died and come back to life, and Elisha brought the child back to life, and then there was a famine. So Elisha had warned her. He said, Lemor kumi lechiat. You know what? It's a good idea for you and your family to pack out of here, because there's going to be a really awful famine. It could be her child was very weak. Certain children are weak, and if there's that one of the reasons children don't fast is because they're not considered, you know, strong enough for the. We're fortunate that. The medicine has accomplished what it has, that we don't worry about our children in the same way they used to. But up until 100 years ago, almost everybody, it was very rare that a family would have all their children make it to adulthood. Even in the houses of the emperors, of the medicine was just such that if somebody would, you know, stab their toe and get an infection, they had no way to heal it. And so lots of people, just all the siblings, it was very rare that they all made it to become adults. So children were weaker and were more susceptible to disease, and it was just part of life that the people lived with. So they were going to a famine, which meant to people their immune system would be weaker because they would be hungry and they wouldn't have the energy. And when they're when there's a famine, you don't get enough vitamins because you don't eat much of anything. So you're short on calcium, you're short on vitamin D, you're short on, and so an adult, at least their body structure is grown. Whereas a child who still hasn't grown, if they're missing these important vitamins, it can be really bad. So Elisha speaks to the woman who he was close with, and he says, you know what? It might be a good idea to ride out the famine in a different place. You know what? Go find the place. I'm not going to tell you where to go. Just funny, go where you want to go. You know, go on vacation. Because, you know, things aren't going to be so good. And it's going to last for 7 years. 7 years is a long time. You know what? Maybe what's interesting is that why did the woman need to be told? Some people say the lesson in the Torah was that in the story of Ruth was that you don't leave your people in the time of famine. In other words, Ruth's husband died because they had abandoned the Jewish people during the famine. Now there, they were leaders. And so leaders, in a difficult time, everybody has to go and escape and try to save what they can save. But somebody who's a leader, somebody who others look up to help them, they shouldn't abandon ship. The story isn't really told well enough, but there were a number of leaders in the Holocaust who stayed with their flock, who could have escaped and didn't. In the Warsaw Ghetto, they offered to save the leaders, the rabbis, the leading rabbis of the ghetto. There was an offer put to the day before the Nazis were going to conquer the ghetto to take this, the leading rabbis out and save them. It's like kind of like a, the Poles had mercy or whatever, and they didn't go. They said, "We're not leaving our people at a time like this. We just can't do it." And there were just many, many heroes like that. It just there were those that escaped too. There were those that felt they couldn't accomplish anything and that they weren't serving as a leader, as a rabbi, and so they just, or they could do more work for their people and once they were free, and there were those that left. But there were plenty that stayed. There was one famous one, Rabbi Wasserman was his name, Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, who was in the United States on a fundraising drive, and he was headed back to Poland, and people said to him, Germany is threatened to, everybody knows there's going to be a war, Europe is arming, it's not the time to go back. And he said, how can I leave my people? How can I, they look up to me. And so a leader, and there were many heads of families that could have escaped, but they didn't want to leave their wife and their children to be overcome by the Nazis, and these people were heroes. They could have escaped. They could have gone, and they looked out for their communities, their families, we're so. I just find it funny. We're always interested in talking about the righteous Gentile or why didn't the Jews fight back? The Holocaust has such funny lessons that we forget that there were some really good lessons. There were some really big heroes that were there. The people that did look out for others, or people that did big sacrifices for others that were amazing. If a person isn't a leader, in the story of Ruth, they were leaders, they really shouldn't have left. But over here, she was just a widow, and not a widow, she was just a... it's interesting that it never mentions the husband. We talked about Tana before. I remember when she wanted to get the building permit, she had to get her husband. But we don't hear much about him. Or when she wants to go to the prophet, the husband says, "Where are you going? It's not a holiday." It's very funny. We don't know anything about that husband, but it's only fair. There's so many times we don't know anything about the wife. I guess there are husbands that are in the background. But over here, Elisha goes and says to her, "You know what? The best thing for you to do would be to ride out the famine. Go find a place to hang out, wherever you want to go. I'm not going to tell you where you want to go, but it's probably not a good time to be at home." Kikor Hashem l'rav v'gam baretz. So that's what happens over here. I'm just trying to explain why it was wrong in the book of Rus, and that's really part of the theme, is don't abandon your people. And over here, it's okay because she wasn't necessarily a leader. She was a mother, and she was responsible for a child, and so the woman did verse 2, v'takamisha v'taskadvari. She got up, and she went, and she went to the land of the Plishtim, which would have been next to the land of Israel. Togobar, it's Plishtim Shevashan. Yeah.
Somewhere it says that she was an influential woman. Somewhere.
An important, yeah, that's true. Could be. Could be she was important or people looked up to her, but it doesn't mean that she would have been able to help anyone in a time of famine, you know, that she could do anything for them.
But she was very rich.
I don't know. Important. It's hard to know what. But the answer that I'm giving is that she wouldn't have been able to do something. If you can prove that she would have, then it would be a question how she, you know, maybe she was needed. The issue here was that the people were worshipping idols and that they were being punished. So, okay, verse 3. V'hi miketz shev shanim. It was after the 7 years. V'tashev ishim eretz plishtim. So after the famine, things got a little better. And she came back. Now, what happened is when she came back home, guess what? There were someone else was in her home in her field. Someone else had taken over her field and her land. So now she has a problem. So now she wanted to get possession of her house and her field back, and the only way to get justice was to try to reach the king. That was the only way in the dictatorships in those days. If you wanted justice, the land and the belonged to her, but she was hoping that she would be able to do something. Verse 4. Malach Medaba Gehazi. Now this is one of those coincidences. We all know there's no such thing as a coincidence. But the king is here, and he's talking to Gehazi. And Gehazi, as you know, was a leper, which is very unusual. The king, some people say that Gehazi became somewhat of a hero after this, because he was the one that told the people that the camp of the enemy had fled. You remember, he was one of the lepers that was outside the camp, and so they told the people that the enemy had fled and that it was safe to go out. And so since he had, perhaps he was became prominent or well-known. So the king was talking to Gehazi. Now, one of the results after seeing all these miracles was that people believed in the powers of Elisha. They believed that he was very great. So the king is talking, he wanted to know more about Elisha. He was, you would think, you know, after all these things that have happened where Elisha warned them when they were trying to capture him, and Elisha healed the general, and it's just an amazing person. So, Amalek Medaba Gehazi Nar Ish Elokim, the king was speaking to Gehazi, who had been close to the man of God, Lamar, Saprana. He said, I want to hear about those miracles. The king had been talking to Gehazi, saying, like, you know, he's finally impressed. Now, it's amazing, after all these miracles, it took him a long time to become, you know, impressed. But he's finally impressed, and he wants to know more. And verse 5, and he said there was this lady, and the lady's child died, and Elisha brought the child back to life. And then, as Elisha is telling it to the king, who's waiting in the king's in the building in the court to meet the king? Right outside is that lady. Behine, and behold, Aisha Shehichis Bana. So Echas Elamah, there she is. So how many times does that happen where you're talking to a person about something and that person just shows up? They're knocking at the door. Like there are coincidences in life. Like there are things that happen for a reason. But and sometimes that's a sign. You know, if you just happen to talk about somebody and there they are. You know, and we all have those, like, it's a surprise. But sometimes maybe Hashem is telling us something. If we have those kind of coincidences where we're just talking about that, and sure enough, you know, it's like somebody senses we're talking about. That's where. So Elisha's talking to the king about this woman. And then they hear, you know, I guess there must have been a line of people waiting to speak to the king, or people were, maybe they cried to the king, you know, they called out. And there it is, the woman is, Tzuekes HaMelech, HaBeis HaBalsada. Yomer Gehazi, and Gehazi says, Adoni Melech, my master the king, Zosisha, there she is, that's the woman. And look, there's the kid. Bona, Shehitya Elisha. So this was the, he told, the Gehazi was telling the king about the story, and sure enough, there the woman was right there. Verse 6. Isha Melech Isha. So the king then talked to the woman, Vitisapilo, and she told him. Now, she probably told him the whole story. The king probably was very interested in the story about being brought back to life and what Elisha had done. So she told him. And then she probably told him also about her problem. Why are you here? And she said, well, you know, she's having trouble getting her field. She's having trouble getting her house back. So she said, the king then gave her an officer saying, Hey, Shiv is called Ashirla. You know what? You should go with this woman and make sure she gets back everything that belongs to her. That's called to us a sudden. Not only should she get back her house and her field, somebody had been plowing that field and working on that field while she was away. Now, it was a famine, so I don't know how much grain there was during the famine, but whatever was there, it's called to us a sudden, Yom Azves Oretz Varata, from the day she left, until now, whoever had taken over her property, her field, her estate, make sure that she gets every penny back. So that was that part of the story. Verse 7. Now again, what happens here is the different events get grouped together, and in Tanakh they're put in the same chapter, but the chapters don't really exist. These chapters are not... they were just put there to kind of make it like nice breaks. They don't really have any special significance to them. So there could be time between one event and another event, but when you see them in the same chapter, you think, oh, they happened, but not necessarily. Elisha goes to Damascus. There's a big mystery why he went to Damascus. So there was a prophecy told to Eliyahu that he should anoint the next king of Aram. And we don't find that he did it. Apparently he left it over for Elisha to do. It's common for a master to have his disciple take care of certain things for him. There's also a tradition that Gehazi had gone to Damascus, and Elisha had tried to get him back. Gehazi had been here for a certain amount of time, and Elisha had gone to try to bring Gehazi back or to... Because Gehazi, it's interesting that we don't usually spend that much time mentioning people if they're not important or they're not significant. So so he was significant in a certain way in with his greed and his leprous in a bad way, but it could be that he had potential. You know, if he was the second in command to Elisha for all those years, perhaps he could have been brought back. I think I had mentioned to you last week that there's even almost like a little criticism that Elisha had pushed him away too strongly by saying that you'll have leprosy forever. You know, you can have leprosy for a little while too. I mean, you don't have to have it forever. That he had, the rule is whenever you, even when you need to be severe with someone, it says that you push away with the left hand and you draw near with the right hand. You should always make sure that even when you're strict, that your attribute of love should be stronger than your attribute of strictness or of, but at any rate, Elisha goes to Damascus. Yavo Elisha Damascus. Uben Adad Melech Aram Chola, and the king of Aram was sick. For you got lo lemor ba ish Elokim ad Hena. They told him, guess what? The man of God is here. Very interesting how the people of other religions and other culture, they also respected the prophets. We find later with Yonah, when Yonah goes to the city of Nineveh, they all knew who he was. They traveled, they went to the land of Israel, they heard about the prophets, they knew about the miracles. So they said, the man of God is here. Verse 8, V'yamar Melech El Hazoel. So Hazoel is his general, or his minister. So the king of Aram said to Hazoel, Kach b'yavcha mincha. He says, here, take a present, v'leik likros ish Elokim, and go and reach the man of God, v'derashe es Hashem me'oso lemor. And find out from God, lemor, hechye mecholizah, find out if I'll get better from this sickness. Now, here also is a fascinating thing. If you'll remember, when the general came with the gift, Elisha didn't take it. Over here, the king offers him a gift and he takes it. Why? If you don't take gifts, you don't take gifts. The truth is, we have this question about Avraham Avinu, that when the king of Sodom, when he conquers the booty in war, and the king of Sodom says, you know, that was my stuff, so he gives it all to the king of Sodom. He doesn't want to take, he says, no one should ever say that I took a penny that belonged to the king of Sodom. Yet Pharaoh offered, after Sarah had been captured, it says that he sent Avraham a gift. Avraham took it. So why is it that sometimes you take a gift and sometimes you don't? What's the difference? So we believe that people should be flexible and should be able to judge each case on its own merits. There are times when you preferred by the general over there, they felt that taking a gift would have been like payment for praying. It would have been like a sign that you did this for the money. The general was... they're particularly like for the general to give him money was like a it was like you know, you do with this as a service for money, not because it was from Hashem. Whereas this is more of a when kings meet someone important, you bring a gift. Even today, you know, when Obama gets meets a you know, met the Queen, he gave her a gift, and she gives him a gift, and that's all a remnant from those. You know, there was a certain protocol when you you know, when people of high station meet each other, you bring a gift. That's just the way. So when somebody's polite and they bring a gift, so even though we don't like to benefit from others, they won't feel good if, like, imagine, let's say somebody comes, you invite someone to your house, and they bring you a bottle of wine, and you say, oh, I'm not going to touch that bottle of wine. They'll feel insulted, because they bring it just to be friendly, or just to show that they feel flattered that you invited them, and then if you refuse the gift, then they'll get insulted. So even though you're not supposed to want gifts, there's a big difference between wanting gifts and if somebody is just being polite and just showing that they appreciate what you did, there's nothing wrong in taking the gift. And so what I'm trying to say is it really depends on the circumstance. You can't always say a rule about it. Take the gift, not take, especially this time of year, there are a lot of gifts out there, right? You take the gift, you not take the gift. It's funny, years ago we used to get, the Kashrus Commission has a lot of businesses that we work with, and sometimes they would send non-kosher food platters to the, you know, for Xmas. And we'd get this, you know, season's greetings from company ABC. And we're like, don't they realize you? But you get on their databases listed as a client or whatever, and someone they want to stay on good terms with. And so it used to be companies would do that. Everybody on their database got a ham or got a, you know, and it was just, boy, did you get the wrong place there? Now I noticed they got more power of, like, we'll get a season's greetings, or we got a card like 2 days ago, and I thought it would say like something about it. It said, let it snow. I said, okay, that's nice and neutral. That's
it said what?
Let it snow.
Oh.
So I guess they figured out that we don't celebrate the holiday at the end of the month or the... So,
what did you do with that food? What do you do with food?
Well, in many cases, you just give it to the janitor or to some non-Jew. Wine's a little more complicated because wine, there's certain rules about you're not supposed to benefit from wine because it was used in religious ceremonies. So if you get non-kosher wine, it's a little more complicated to give it away. But either way, I'm just saying the concept of when to know, there's an idea that we want to be givers in life and not takers. And so in general, we don't wait in line for gifts. On the other hand, there are times when you accept a gift, it's just a way to let somebody reciprocate or show that they appreciate, and there's nothing wrong in taking that gift. And so I think that's the message over here in his taking of the gift. Verse 9, he took the gift, the called to the mustard. This was a nice gift, too. It was 40 camels. I guess that's a nice gift, 40 camels worth of food. Bincha. Now, it's very interesting. He says, your son, Ben-Hadad, you know, he calls him the king of, in some respect, it wants to show the difference, you know, here the king of the 10 tribes was not even on talking terms to Elisha, and he had to ask someone else about what Elisha did, and yet the king of Aram, which was right next door, he calls Elisha, he says, he calls him father. He says, your son, Ben-Hadad. He said, will I get better from this sickness? Verse 10. Go and tell him. Lo chaya. This is very interesting words. You got to look in the Hebrew for this a little bit. He says to him, now, the way, there's a few different, this is one of those texts that in the original Hebrew is not so clear. The word emar lo is together. It could be read, say to him, emar lo chaya sichya, you will surely live. Or, if you read lo, lo is one of those words that can be read as don't, or you say to him. Lo could be to him. Amar, it could be emar, say lo, no, or emar lo, say to him. It depends on how you, you can't really tell in Hebrew.
But it's a different letter. It's involved in an analysis.
So. It's not real clear. When he spoke to him, it wasn't in writing. He was speaking. So if he said, Omar lo, if he said to him, Chaya Sichya, so it could be, because we can see from his answer that he didn't tell him you'll die, but on the other hand it says, Lo Chaya Sichya, you won't live. Actually, what it, Amor lo, that, say to him, Chaya Sichya, you will surely live. Vareni Hashem ki most yamus. What he told the messenger was, you tell the king that he will get better. But between me and you, God has told me that he will surely die. What most people say is that his sickness, he wasn't going to die from his sickness. This messenger, this officer, was going to assassinate him. And so what he was telling the messenger was, you should know that this emperor is not going to live much longer. But he wanted to know whether he would die from the sickness. Amar lo, so he say to him, lo, chaya sichya, you will surely live. That was the message that he was giving this person. V'yameid es panav. And so he was giving this message to the messenger of the king of Aram, and he turned away his face. V'yosem ad bosh. And he held it a long time, and then he started crying. In other words, his message was that this particular king would die. Now, this king was not such a good king either, but that the king would die and there would come a new king. And this new king was the messenger. And Elisha is crying. Vayomer Chazoyel. Chazoyel says, Medua Adoni Bocha, why does my master cry? Vayomer, and he answers in verse 12, Ki Yadati Yisheshetas Ibnei Yisrael, because he says, you're going to be king, and I know that you're going to be a cruel king. I know what you're going to do to the Jewish people. Ra mibsarehem, you're going to be bad or mean to the children of Israel. Tishlat be'esh, you're going to set the buildings on fire. Ubecharehem becharev, you're going to kill the young men with the sword. Tarav, va'olehem tartesh, va'oreseim tavaka, and you're going to do terribly brutal things to the children and the pregnant women. And Aram was vicious in war, and so he said here Elisha is talking to him, and he says, why are you crying, my master? And he says, because I know how wicked you're going to be. Verse 13. Vayomer Chazoyel. Chazoyel said, Ki ma abdecha kelo ki yasa davar garozeh. Now, Chazoyel says that not that I would never do such a thing. He doesn't say that. He says, but I'm just a cog in the wheel. I'm just a dog. I'm not very powerful. And so then Elisha tells them, V'yomer Elisha, Hareini Hashem Osaf Melech Al Aram. Hashem has told me that you are going to be the next king. Wow. So it's just interesting. We couldn't have made up such a story. I don't know why it had to happen, what the significance of it is. Verse 14, V'yeg Meis Elisha. So he goes from Elisha, V'yava Adona V'yomer Lo. Ma Omer Lo Elisha, what did Elisha tell you? Omer Lo. Omer Lo Chaya Sichya. Elisha said, oh, you're going to live. Behima Machra, so what's the next? Vikaka Mikbar Vifa Bamayim. He took a cloth and he dipped it in water, Vifrish Al Panav. And he put it on the king's face, Vyamas. Basically, he suffocated him, according to most people. You could say it's not so clear. Maybe he didn't mean to do it. Maybe the king died on his own. But it looks like you see him taking this thing and spreading it on the king's face. V'yamas v'yimah Chazal tachtav, and Chazal became the king after him. Right, the people were worshiping idols, and the ten tribes had set up the golden calves, and so the people were like slowly getting away from the service of Hashem, and so therefore Hashem eventually sent them into exile. Okay, we'll stop here, verse 16, we'll get back to with the death here of the king of Aram and the new king Hazael taking over.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.